Hi, everyone. Welcome to Books at Noon. It's lovely to see you on this beautiful day. I'm here with A. Hotchner, who is a novelist, biographer, and playwright. He has written 18 books, an international bestseller called Papa Hemingway, about Ernest Hemingway. He's also written a memoir called King of the Hill, which was about his childhood in St. Louis during the Depression, and it was adapted by Steven Soderbergh into a movie several years back. He is also the co-founder of Newman's Own Food with his friend Paul Newman and Hole in the Wall Camp for Sick Children. And I'm very happy to have him here today, and please welcome. I am going to sort of span his work, since there are 18 books, and there were biographies on Doris Day and Sophia Loren and two on Ernest Hemingway. And I wanted to know how you get the intimate story of these people. I mean, how do you get them to relax? How do you get that story?
Well, the easy ones are when you know somebody for a long time. I knew Hemingway for 14 years, so you have that as your background. And that kind of a biography or a memoir is easy to write because you've got your own experiences with the person.
Talk right into it.
How's that?
Bravo.
But when you come on cold with somebody like Doris Day, probably some people here don't even remember who Doris Day was, but she was the number one actress and singer in the world for 4 or 5 years, and she's still on television. But if the person is forthcoming, that's the easiest. But they've been interviewed by so many magazine people over the years. They have a kind of a preconceived notion of themselves because that's what they've been telling. So what you want to do is to establish a kind of understanding so that they trust you, that if they tell you things that really shouldn't be divulged, you won't divulge them. Because I never allow any subject to read what I write about them before publication. Now, in the case of Sophia Loren, I mean, Doris was marvelous. She was open. I spent 8 months in Hollywood seeing her every morning from 9 until she got hungry. We would go every morning to Al's Delicatessen on our bicycles. She ate the heartiest breakfast I've ever seen anybody consume.
What was it? Do you remember?
And
what was the breakfast?
What?
What was the breakfast?
Well, the breakfast was usually about 3 eggs, cereal, a little lox thrown in. And then she was so beloved by the guys behind the counter, they'd send over offerings, bagels with some strange thing on top of them. And Dora, that was her meal of the day. And I said, how do you maintain eating a breakfast like that? How do you maintain a body like you have? Because she had a marvelous body. She was a dancer. And she said, oh, well, I just take care of myself. For example, once a week, I have a big bottle of big jar of Vaseline. And I, usually on a Monday, I take the Vaseline, and from my head to my feet, I cover myself with Vaseline. And then I put on a flannel nightgown, thoroughly covered with Vaseline, and I go to bed. The only danger is that occasionally I slip out of bed and I get hurt a little. So when you get on that basis with somebody, they're going to tell you marvelous things about themselves. She had a very negative feeling about her father. But by the time we were through with our 8 or 9 months, she was in love with her father. And actually in the book, he comes out very well, because in the process of dealing with it, she revealed things that she had never revealed to herself. But with Sophia, it was totally different. Sophia fancied herself as the queen of the Silver Screen. So she would show up at 9 o'clock every morning, all put together like she was about to appear in a film. And for about a week or two, she would answer whatever questions I asked in a very stately fashion. And at the end of the week or 10 days, I came in, I tape all of them so that I know exactly what they say, but that if they protest about anything, I can play the tape and show them that I honestly covered it. But in Sophia's case, I came in on about the 10th day, and I had 2 tapes. And I said, Sophia, listen, I have to be honest. You know about these two tapes, how good they are? They're this good, and I dropped them in the wastebasket. She said, that's 10 days of interviews. I said, yes, but you told me everything that you've told Photoplay and that you've told the Ladies' Home Journal, and why would anybody buy a book about your life? That's not your life. That's the life you'd like everybody to, in beginning with her. I put in a fresh tape and I said, we'll try one more tape or then I can't do this book. And she said, well, what do you want me to tell you? I said, tell me about your father. I have found, parenthesis, I have found that in dealing with females, women, the father is the clue to the bridge that you get to the part of them that you want to write about. She said, my father, I didn't know my father at all. My father was a terrible man, and there's no way that I can talk to you about my father. Beginning there, I knew we were on good grounds, because that was really the most important thing to talk about. And actually, the book begins with Sophia at her father's deathbed. And from then on, she was thoroughly open about what she had to say. But you have to find a key to get to that part of their insides, that they trust you and that they face things they don't want to face themselves. So in the case of those two women,
it was the father.
The books were really revelatory, and they had wide readership because people reading them identified with what they were saying, and they knew it was true. Truth is very difficult to come by when you deal with any of these people.
What is it about the genre that you liked so much? I mean, you wrote a lot of biographies, so you must have enjoyed. Was it that people would slowly reveal themselves? That you learn things that you... I mean, what was it about it that you liked so much?
Well, if you get someone who has achieved fame, whatever that word means, and had lived a rich life, and if you can get them to tell you enough so that you can translate that into the emotion of the reader, then, of course, you've achieved something that is beyond fiction, because some lives are beyond fiction. I mean, Ernest's life, and I was around him for those 14 years, so I lived some of the life that he was living. But certainly, if I were to create a character that had the projection that Hemingway had. I couldn't have done as well as just honestly portraying Hemingway. And by the way, the portrayal of Hemingway as this macho figure, like Woody Allen's guy in the back seat in his movie, he was not a macho man.
Let's talk about Hemingway. How did you first meet Hemingway?
Well, I just got out of the Air Force, and the only job I could find was with Cosmopolitan magazine. It was then a literary magazine before Helen Gurley Brown sexed it up. But the only job I had, they gave me a list of writers who had written for them before the war, and they said, if you'll go find them and get them to write something for us, we'll pay you $500 for everybody you can do. So I was a literary bounty hunter. And one person on the list was Hemingway in Cuba. And I went down there and I sent him a note. And I said, look, I'm down here for a ridiculous thing to get you to write an article on the future of literature. And I know that's dumb. Just tell me that's dumb so I can go back and show them that I really saw
it. It was the future of literature? Is that what you said? It was
about future of literature.
Okay.
So to my absolute amazement, I sent a note out to him because I knew that it would be just absolutely rubbish to try to go to the door of his finca, which was outside of Havana. And he called me in my hotel room. He said, let's have a drink. And he said, listen, I don't know about the future of tomorrow, much less literature. And that's how we met. And
you were, but you spent, I mean, a good time sort of having adventures with him. I mean, you went hunting with him.
Actually, he did write future literature. He wrote a book called Across the River and Into the Trees. And he took me out on his boat right away, and we caught some fish, and he was rather isolated.
He was.
And I was somebody who was, at that point, looking for what I was going to write about in life and what was I going to do. So he took me on as a kind of a son. And I think that helped a lot. But Hemingway was really a very gentle man and a poet. If you read all the books that he's written, the lead character is not a macho guy. They all die heroically.
Yes.
The short stories, you'll find no tough stuff, rough guys, tough guys. It's not there. What made Hemingway were the colonists. At that time, colonists had a great deal of power. And they invented that man whose interests, of course, were quite masculine. He was the first one who really popularized bullfighting. No one was very much aware of it.
Do you mind telling the audience just a brief...
What?
The anecdote that you tell at the Moth, which is longer, but that you... Didn't he manage you at one point and you...
Yeah.
Wasn't there a bullfighting? I mean, if you can just briefly, because it's a great story.
I'll make it as brief as possible. There was a summer in 1958 or 9 when he was going to write an account for Life magazine of the bullfight rivalry between Antonio Ordóñez, who was a great matador at that time, and his brother-in-law, who was just as great. And they were doing a mano a mano, which means a hand-to-hand, just the two of them, and it was kind of a deadly rivalry. And on one occasion, after one of those bullfights, we were following them around Spain, going from one bullfight encounter to another. And we were, after a bullfight, we were all having a good time and drinking a lot of wine, and Antonio said, you know, you have the making of a matador. and maybe you should go in the ring with me. And Hemingway said, fine, I'll be your manager. And I thought that was a very funny evening. We all had a lot of laughs. And he said, the next time the mano a mano is in Ciudad Real, and I'll take you in the ring with me. So when we got there, which was about a week or two later, I had forgotten all about it. We went to Antonio's hotel room, and there was a traje de luz, a bullfighter suit, for me. And I said, oh, that's very funny. But a sword handler came over, and we put on the suit, got all ready to go, and just before we left the room, everybody went on the room except Antonio and me, and there was a little altar on the side where Antonio prayed. He had a little Madonna and things, and he was in his corner praying, and I was in my corner also praying without anything to pray to, because I actually was taken to the bull ring and actually had to go in the bull ring with the great Antonio. But I didn't fight a bull, but they did pass a bull through.
Were you terrified?
What?
Were you terrified? You must have been.
I was absolutely stiff with fear. Because I had to come out on the bull fight. I was the sobresaliente. That means the second sword. And that means that, realistically, with a regular bullfight, if you're the sobresaliente and the two matadors get gored, you have to kill the bull. And of course, I couldn't even kill my fear at that point. But at any rate, Antonio was wonderful, and he said, come on, tour the ring with me. So we toured the ring together, and I felt like I was really one of the matador assistants. The Spanish people love their matadors, and they throw everything at them, hats and bags and bottles of wine. Everything gets showered, money, cigars. Antonio said, Pecas, that was my nickname. I was El Pecas. That means the freckled one, which I was then. At any rate, he said, let's tour the ring together, but you just pick up the lady's shoes. I thought, well, now that's pretty strange. There's money and cigars and everything all over the place, and I've got to pick up lady's shoes, which I did, but the bullfight costume was very tight, and it was very hard getting down to pick up the shoes. But by the time we toured the ring, there I am with an armful of shoes, ladies' shoes. And a bunch of men put Antonio on their shoulder and parade him down the street. And I'm left in the middle of the ring with all these ladies' shoes, and I barely got to the wagon that went back to the hotel. And Ernest said, just throw all the shoes on the bed there and come on, have some wine. And we went in and we had wine, and there was a knock on the door, and Antonio said, answer the door, Pegasus. And there stands a gorgeous young senorita, and she's wearing one shoe. And she said, I've come for my shoe. And I said, oh, come on in. Yeah, which one is yours? There were about 15 shoes on the bed. So she picked up her shoe, and I put it on her dainty foot. And Ernest said, now come, daughter, come have some wine and top us. And after that, there was a knock on the door, and a knock on the door, and a knock on the door. And we had 10 beautiful senoritas in that room. And there was Antonio, his whole quadrilla, and all the ladies joined us, and that was a hell of an evening.
That's a great story. Before I ask you about fame, I wanted to know about your friendship with Paul Newman, who is another sort of iconic American figure. And you met him when you were both in the infancy of your careers, so you really sort of built your careers together. I mean, you saw him early on.
It's a bridge from Hemingway, because at some point, Hemingway was being besieged by television and movie producers to acquire some of his work. So he said to me, listen, you're in New York. If there is anything that anybody wants to do that is feasible. So Fred Cole was his producer, came to me and he said, there's a short story of his called The Battler.
The what?
Battler. Battler. And Ernest said, okay, they can acquire it, but you do the screenplay because I'm afraid of what they'll do to it. I'd never written one, but I wrote a television play, and it was accepted, and Arthur Penn was the director, and they had James Dean to play the lead. And I thought, well, this is a stroke of luck. I mean, my first television play, I got Jimmy Dean to be the lead of it. But Dean got killed in his sports car crash, and they had no lead. And it was really required somebody strong to play the lead. This was live television, not taped, live. And they couldn't get a replacement. And Arthur Penn, who was the director, said, you know, there's a young man in this cast who has a small part, but I know him from the Actor's Studio. I think he could do this. And that was Paul Newman. And he was put in the lead. So my first television play was Paul's first starring part. And beginning there, we had a great friendship. I did do a couple of movies that he did. And he was a great example of somebody who really enjoyed his life, but wasn't really like the person on the screen. I mean, he was a little like Butch Cassidy, I would say.
Oh, really?
A little bit. But one day, one Christmas day, almost Christmas, maybe 3-4 days before, he called me up. We both lived in Westport. And he said, listen, I need some help. Can you come on over? I only live 10 minutes from him. So I went over, and he was down in the abandoned stables under his barn. And he was on the ground, which was all dirt. And he had a wash tub and a lot of old wine bottles. And he had ingredients, olive oil and stuff like that.
Oh, it started with the dressing, yeah.
So he said, look, why don't we make some of my dressing? He was very proud of his dressing. We'll make it for the neighbors. Go around with the kids and sing carols and give them bottles of my wine. So there were a few bottles left over after we did this. And he said, why don't we put it in the local stores, see whether they really like my wine? I said, you can't do that. These are dirty wine bottles. And if you have no insurance, I had been a lawyer.
You were the business mind behind Newman's Own.
No, I had practiced law for 2 years, so I knew this was a good way to lose the barn and everything with it. So that was the beginning. We found a bottler, one bottle of salad dressing. We found a bottler, and we put a few bottles in once we got the right labels and whatever.
And where did you start did you, with the proceeds afterwards, start the camp for the hole-in-the-wall camp sick children?
We put up $40,000, $20,000 each, just to buy labels. And we agreed that once we lost the $20,000 or $40,000, we would close shop. But we didn't. It caught on. People began to buy it in the local stores, and then the big supermarket there, Stu Leonard's, took, I don't know, 200-400 bottles, something like that. And we got orders. And Paul said, now, wait a minute. We can't go into the food business. You know, I'm an actor, you're a writer. What are we doing in the food business? And I said, you got us there. We better do sink or swim.
Well, now it's extraordinary. It's everywhere.
So we began to make money. And he said, let's don't make money out of food. Why don't we give all our profits to charity? Everything, every penny. Let's don't make any money.
Amazing.
I hesitated. This was no cinch. because I saw those orders. There, you know, there was
I bet. It's, yeah.
And they were all there. But I thought, oh, what the hell, a philanthropist? I never thought I'd be a philanthropist, but I could be a philanthropist. Well, make maybe $100,000, $200,000 and give it to charity. We just gave away the total now is $420 million.
Amazing. Amazing. I have so many questions to ask you. And you have a fabulous book, which we didn't even talk about, which are essays that are... I wanted to ask just one quick question. It's a really lovely book about aging. It takes the sting out of aging. And I wondered if these were anecdotes or diary entries that you then turned into essays, or you decided, I'm just going to start writing essays about aging that are humorous, or...
Well, exactly. The book is called OJ in the Morning, Gin and Tonic at Night. And it's called that. And speaking of Paul, and of Ernest, and of Doris, all of them, the one thing they shared, and that gets me into the book, the one thing they shared was they enjoyed their life. They lived fully. You can... Perhaps all of you say, oh, sure, the movie stars are making a lot of money, and that's not the point. I can tell you I know a lot of important people, movie stars and others, who are not enjoying their lives at all. They are miserable. These people did, and because they realized that just going to a movie set and churning out episodes one day after another was not fulfilling. And they learned how to have some joie de vivre, some joy in life. And that's what the book's about. Well, OJ in the Morning means, or, you know, people today, I have people come to me, they turn 50 or they turn 60. And they all of a sudden they begin to see that, oh my God, Social Security is coming up. They become aware of aging, and they look upon it as something that they have to prepare for. Like you put on a bulletproof vest, and it shouldn't be that way. So they come to me and they say, what's the secret? Look at you. You're still around. You're still enjoying your life. And I tell them, that's the secret. Drink orange juice in the morning and have gin and tonic at night and enjoy everything in between. And so that's what the book's really about.
Well, it's wonderful.
And I hope that a lot of people will begin to realize after you read some of the book. Some of the book warns you. I mean, it warns you to not watch the evening news with all of its medical advice. By the time you're through watching the evening news, at least 8 of those commercials will say, ask your doctor. Especially the commercials,
what, there's so many.
For bringing you up to the level you were. I don't know how to put this exactly delicately. But you know what I mean. Do you know there are at least 6 or 8 major companies now churning out? You can rub it under your arm or...
Oh, I know.
There's so many ways that you can get your libido back.
Well, you are a great testament.
You know what they have in common? One thing they all have in common on the screen says, see our ad in Golf Digest. Makes you think about golfers. I thought right away, well, maybe, you know, maybe that was Tiger Woods, and maybe that's what got him in trouble. It says, you can be ready.
Well, listen, I could talk to you. I have so many questions, and you have so many stories. And unfortunately, we just have a half an hour. And I wanted to ask, I probably only have time for about 2 questions from the audience. So do you mind answering some questions? Anyone have some questions?
I've answered everything.
There's so much. Oh, here's somebody right over there.
Towards you, not from the speaker. Can you take us back in your early life with your mom and dad and your family, and what was the instances in that period that put you on the path where you are today?
Well, I wrote about my early life in King of the Hill, which was made into a very good movie directed by Steven Soderbergh. And as a matter of fact, it just came out last month in Blu-ray. And there's an interview in which I talk about my childhood. You know, somebody once asked Hemingway when I was with him, what's the best equipment for a writer? And he said, a really unhappy, tough childhood. So that's what I had. It was the worst part of the Depression, and I had to survive the unsurvivable. So I would say that my early life really mirrored what was going to sustain me, because I was left alone in a flea bag hotel when I was 12 years old. My mother had to go to a sanitarium with tuberculosis, and my father made an abortive attempt to be a salesman. And I had to survive that summer in St. Louis under threat of being thrown out of the hotel room for lack of payment of our rent. And if you can really endure hardships like that, I do believe you have a confidence that you can survive any hardship. And as you get older, and I went into the Air Force and all of that, that equipment, that early equipment, is just something it's the baggage, the good baggage that you carry with you. And I say that's really what sustained me and also gave me a lot of stuff to write about, because I wrote a lot about my boy, but especially in King of the Hill. Well, thank you. Good audience.
Thank you so much. Thank you. A. Hotchner will be signing at the bookstore behind me, and it's a 20% discount off the books. Thank you so much. I hope to see you next week. When it's Joyce Carol Oates at Books at Noon. Thanks a lot. Take care.